Accession number 9146, rule number 3.
Brigadier Wedderburn Maxwell, tape 3. You were explaining about the periscopes and how you saw these advertised in Punch. Were you able then to send for one of these?
Yes.
Individually?
Oh, yes. Oh. I sent for one, and it was absolutely invaluable, because you were seeing everything as clear as daylight through your field glasses, and your own head was in complete safety from rifle fire. But the powers from behind sent up a big steel plate about the size of this table, and pretty thick, with two slits cut in it, a vertical and a horizontal. And if you put your field glasses right up against those cuts, you saw as clear as daylight, absolutely clear view of what you were looking at. And the idea being that there's a nice steel plate, nobody's going to be able to do anything about it. But I wasn't very long a soldier, but I'd been a soldier long enough not to trust anybody but yourself. And so I put it up against a tree, this thing, and took an ordinary service rifle with an ordinary bullet, and put it slap through this steel plate, which meant that it was not much of a safeguard for me. So I sent it back again, took it back to the bat and said, this is what happened. They turned it down.
Did you ever get a better one than that?
No, it didn't bother me.
Because the idea sounded very good.
Well, the idea was excellent. If only the steel had been good. No, it wasn't pursued. It was a good idea. Knowing that the rays of light came through the split.
You were saying that on the in December there was a lot of activity. I think you participated in a raid. Am I right in that?
Oh yes.
Where was that?
That was up still in our original positions, and we were again covering the Lincolns, and they wanted to do a raid across the German lines to find out who was there, get a prisoner if possible, and we got to be ready to support it with our guns. And so we called registered by day, fired our guns till we hit the target, and then that was what you wanted, your line and your range and your angle, and all the other guns took it from you. And you were all ready. And our plan was that once the Lincolns had been to the German trenches and killed a German or two, and possibly got a prisoner, I think they got a prisoner, I'm not certain, they came back again, and as soon as they were back in our own trenches, where I was standing with my telephone, up went the signal, and down came my fire. So the Germans were all, there was tremendous rifle fire when they found that they were being raided. Rifles going off in all directions. And we knew that they were manning their parapets, and that's where we put our fire. Of course, some rounds were effective and some weren't. I suppose, by and large, they weren't. But it's made other people put their heads down. That was just an ordinary little raid. It got very unpopular later on, because when you began to get casualties and the wire got so much thicker, the barbed wire, a belt of 20 yards of, 20 foot thick of wire coils was a horrible obstacle. And it did frightful havoc later on when the poor old infantry found themselves up against uncut wire. That cutting of wire was one of our jobs as gunners, but the ammunition, the shrapnel ammunition, was no good. That those little balls didn't cut the wire, so it was when we came to high explosive shells instead that sort of blew it apart, and that was a great deal more effective when we came to that first real battle. We had this place called Neuve Chapelle.
Yes, I must ask you about that. That would be a little later.
Yes, that was later. That was March.
Yes,
the first
yes.
March.
We seem now to be coming to Christmas 1914.
Yes.
And I wonder if you have any direct experience of the so-called Christmas truce of that year.
Yes, I had absolute personal experience. I was at the wagon line with the horses on Christmas morning, and I went up, was told that I was going to go to the OP that night, but that I was to come up in time for dinner. And so the dinner at the battery with the other four officers. And so I went up, and there Mossy Moore, who was a proper old alcoholic, pockmarked, I don't know if you've ever had smallpox or what, and grey hair and a game leg. He's a real old card. I don't think he enjoyed the war a great deal, but he commanded the battery for a bit when my major left. And we had a wonderful Christmas dinner of plum pudding and turkey and stuff. I forget how we got hold of it all. And then after dinner, then at dinner, Mossy told us that he'd been up that day with Mickey the vet, and that the Germans were all out of their trenches, walking about outside, not mending the wire. That wasn't allowed for some reason. Somebody fixed up, it wasn't allowed, but pumping the water out of the trenches and improving your own breastworks and so on. And we were doing the same. And the Germans had put up on Christmas Eve three or four Christmas trees, and they were all singing carols, and our people joined in. And the firing Verey lights. They always fired many Verey lights. You know what a Verey light is? At night, just to keep an eye on no man's land to see if there's nothing moving there. And of course, if you were on patrol in no man's land, you froze the moment the Verey light went up below you. But they went on their lights, and then Mossy came back to dinner with us, and I went on up. My groom was there with my horses, and I rode up the usual way to within about 300 or 400 yards.
This was on Christmas Day?
Yes, on Christmas Day itself. And I told my two signalers who I had with me what was happening, what had been happening all day, and said, I'm going to go and have a look in the morning, see what things are like then. The next morning, nothing was happening, and I went up through the communication trenches to the infantry. And when I got there, I found that they were all getting out of their trenches, and out of their ditches, or behind their breastworks, and they were working out in no man's land too. And some of them even met the Germans. And there was a party a couple hundred yards away of our troops and the Germans all fraternizing. And so I said, right, I'm going to go inside and have a look at this. And I told the infantry to keep an eye on me in case anybody tried the roughhouse and to know what was happening. And I went up and I met a small party who said, oh, come along into our trenches and have a look at us. I said, no, I'm quite near enough as it is. And we laughed and we chaffed each other, and I gave them some English tobacco, and they gave me some German, I forget what it was, and we walked about for about half an hour in no man's land. And then we shook hands, wished each other luck, and one fellow said, will you send this off to my girlfriend in Manchester? And so I took his letter and I franked it and sent it off to his girlfriend in Manchester. And I got back.
What were you talking to them about for half an hour? Can you remember the sort of gist?
Well, just saying how bloody it was in that mud and how we hated it all and all that. And they said, we are Saxons, you are Anglo-Saxons, why are we fighting? Said, the Russians can't fight, the French won't fight, and you're the only people who do fight. And why are we doing it? And they said, we've had a tremendous victory in Poland and taken 1 million prisoners. And I believe they had a very, very big thing in those lakes, the Mazurian lakes, I think. And They were very cocky. We said the war's going to be over by Christmas, and they said, well, that's what we tell our people. All you tell your people is damn lies. All your people tell you is damn lies. And then, after that, I came back, and at midnight, we were ordered into action because there was a very strong rumour from a German deserter, to say that there was going to be an attack from La Basse right up to the coast, and we had to start on our SOS firing to break up any attack that came across the no man's land.
How did you feel about firing at these people you'd been talking to after that?
Well, it was our job.
Had you any idea how extended that was, that truce? What part
of
the line?
There was rifle fire going on to our right, and there were certain amounts of artillery fire and rifle fire away to our left. This, my particular experience, was without any of this. Though I understand that further to the north, by our Montier, the same thing was happening, and there's talk, I've heard, I never saw it, of a football being kicked about.
You didn't hear of a football game in your area?
No, we just walked about on there. It's a very hard and all broken up land. You couldn't have played if you wanted to.
Could I just establish the area where this occurred, this sort of fraternization?
Well, names don't mean much to anybody, even people who were alive then. But there was a very nice little place called Lavanti, and there was Esther, and Esther was a home from home.
And what were the troops that would have been involved in this? You mentioned the Germans were Saxons.
Yes.
Is that right? Would have they have been a Saxon division?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, no doubt about that. But I don't remember which division it would be or anything like that.
And the British, could I establish which British troops would have been
That would be the Royal Irish Rifles, or the Lincolns, or the Berkshires. The Royal Irish Rifles became the Royal Ulster Rifles, and now they're called something else.
Were there any French or Belgian troops involved?
No, there were no French within 10 miles of us. They were on our right, down below a place called Bagneuve-Chapelle. That's where the French met us. And way up north, up by above Ypres, we by that time we were holding the front as far as Ypres. Oh, God.
Do you think it made a difference, the fact that those Germans were Saxon and not Prussians, perhaps?
It might well, because the Prussian officers were such a tough lot, ruthless lot, that had they been in that situation, they would probably not have allowed it.
And how about the British troops? Do you think it might not have happened with different British troops?
Terribly hard. You see, on some occasions in war, one funny little man, maybe a private soldier, might be an NCO, might be an old officer, will take the lead in something. And it's possible that one of our people waved across, I guess it was a white flag, or we weren't allowed white handkerchiefs, we only had the khaki ones, but waved something. And drew a response to the other side, or the Germans might have done the same. One doesn't know, but it can evolve from one man's brain. I've seen it happen in disaster, with terrible casualties and things, how one man will step out and take charge. Man who just thought it was just an ordinary driver looking after two horses, and then it was something in him, a bit of leadership that's exploded at the critical moment. So I suppose it happens everywhere, but it certainly does happen in the army.
Did you yourself hear how the Christmas truce had started?
No, I didn't. No, Mossy may have told us for Christmas Day, when we met at dinner, but I don't remember anything of how it started.
Were you really surprised when you heard of this?
I was amazed, and I was terribly, terribly sick at not having been up there to see it myself, never dreaming I was going to have the full works the next morning.
Do you think there was any religious connotations with this?
Not, no, except there's a religious element in carols and even in Christmas tree. I suppose there probably was, even if it wasn't recognised as such.
Do you think it had any effect on your troops from what you saw afterwards?
No.
When they had to fire at the Germans, they did so quite readily, did they?
Oh, they still kill any German they could see to kill. The end of the truce... The end of the truce was signaled by a salvo of artillery.
And which side?
Midnight on Boxing Night.
And which side gave that salvo?
I read it. To the best of my memory.
And did the Germans respond right away?
No, then people just reverted to living in their mud holes.
Was there any official reaction to this truce, so far as you
know? I didn't hear of it, but there was later on, 2 years later on the Somme.
What happened then?
I was doing FOO as a captain, or as a temporary major, I can't remember which, with the Grenadiers, up at a place called Saïs-Saïs-Sel. And the order had gone out throughout the Guards Division. They were all in one division by now. Magnificent show it was, the Guards Division. The order went out, court-martialed any man seen fraternizing in any way with the enemy. You had to keep the hate going.
That was 2 years later, in 1916,
yes.
Was anything said in 1915 about it?
In 15, we were out at rest. Out at rest and training, playing football and boxing. And we had 6 weeks, and we needed it too, pretty badly. We were absolutely massacred at Neuve Chapelle, of course. Anyhow.
Do you know if anyone was punished or ticked off about that fraternising?
I should say no. I should say, not only do I not know, but I don't think it happened.
Did you hear of that happening on any other occasion during the war? Any fraternisation?
No, I didn't. No, I think it is quite unique.
Do you think it could have happened again at a later stage in the war? When obviously, things had increased?
No, I don't think it could. Everybody was pretty savage by then.
Did it have any implications for you at the time, that truce? Did it have a big effect on you? I think you said you wrote to your mother about it.
Yes, yes. No, mostly excitement. I think that is one of the big things. Fear or really serious danger, you have to have a very exciting effect, balanced or counterbalanced by fear. I remember once at this particular OP, I had a little cottage right up in full view of the trenches. My signals lived in the kitchen, and there was a bedroom upstairs, but I had to lie on the floor upstairs because the bullets could come. There weren't streams of bullets, but the odd bullet did come in through the windows. And of course, down below there was brickwork, and you were all right lying down there, but you didn't take any chances. But I was going up one day. I don't remember where I'm from, but walking across the orchard from the main road towards the trenches and towards where my little house was hidden in an orchard, and I suddenly heard a distant sort of a murmur. By then I knew what that meant, and the murmur got louder and louder and louder until it was a very close whistle, and I went down flat, and almost at once two shells burst. Next day I paced them. They were 12 yards apart and I was in the middle. And they went into the mud, and just I was spattered with mud, and that was all. My signals thought I was absolutely blown to bits. They were standing in the door of my little house watching me walk up to see this. So when that happened, I upped and ran like stink. But this was probably the nearest I ever had.
If I could go back to the Christmas truce, was it discussed much afterwards? Did you talk
about it? Yes, I think it was. We did, yes. But we looked upon Jerry as a sort of the other side of the game of football, almost. And there was a sort of not an affection, a respect, I should think. An acceptance that we were both doing our jobs.
Did it make you query the war in any way? The fact that you could be talking to people one day and then having to fight them the next? Did it?
No, I don't think it had any psychological effect on us. No, I think it's just an event.
And there was no feeling of sort of betrayal or treachery about this?
No,
time.
There was no feeling of any. In fact, it was rather the opposite. We regarded each other as sportsmen.
Is that how you think it was regarded, as a sort of sporting occasion?
I suppose it was rather, yes, to go and talk to Jerry. Yes, I think it was.
But it's interesting you saying you don't think it could have happened later in the war.
No, because the high command took charge at once when they found this. I mean, after all, what you were rather, not elaborating, but what you were suggesting very rightly was that it might have an effect on our willingness to fight. And that was, above all things, got to be avoided in a war. You can't have to. It was bad enough 3 years later when the French army mutinied almost to a man. And that is why we had to fight the Battle of Passchendaele.
Yes, I must ask you about that later on.
Yeah.
You're explaining how the Germans invited you to go and see their lines.
Yes.
Were you know, why didn't you take advantage of that offer?
Because I was pretty certain I'd never come out of it again.
Did you really?
Well, see, we were 50-50 out in the open. We were equally balanced, more or less. Not by numbers, but by the fact of this fraternizing just about halfway between the two lines of defense. And nobody wanted to start up a war. But if they'd got me in there, I'd have been, even to the youngster with only one star, I'd have been a very valuable prisoner of war.
Did any of the Germans come into your lines?
No.
No, so
no we just had a sort of a gentleman's agreement.
How do you think they looked, the German troops?
Oh, looked very good. Well turned out, clean, good uniforms, healthy. Oh, no, they looked all right. Some very young. There were one or two very young ones. One was put in kind of 18, if not younger.
And how about the language? Did you speak in...
One was an American. Another was a waiter at the Ritz. There were several of them talked quite a bit of English. Yes, because before the First War, nearly all the barber shops in this country were Germans.
And this American German, he would have been a German who'd gone to America to work and come back, would he?
I think that's probably what happened, yes.
Is there anything else at all about that truce that you think...
The what?
Is there anything else at all about the truce that you can remember? Well, how about your parents' reaction when you wrote and told them about it?
Well, my father was delighted to have a letter giving such a description of events, and he sent them up to the Daily Telegraph. And I've got the copies here. They give the whole picture, interlarded with personal things, I suppose, on occasion. But I got into a frightful rocket because my senior subaltern, the old pockmarked alcoholic, he recognized the style and the story, talking about Mickey the vet going off to the German line, towards the German lines, where they were waving a bottle at him, and he found the bottle was empty. And all that showed up that it must have been me who wrote it, and he, Mossy, got hold of me, gave me an awful dressing down for daring to write to the press. But of course I didn't. My old man wrote to the press and said it was nothing to argue about, and it didn't do me any harm. And let him get a little bit of steam off.
Do you think drink was involved with this at all?
No, I shouldn't think it was. You couldn't get drink. We had a tot of rum, and the cap that went over your fuses was a little triangular thing, rather like that, rather like an inverted wine glass, in fact. And the rum came up in a big earthenware jar, labelled SRD, and I never found out what SRD meant, except that it was rum. And Under bad conditions, the troops always had a tot of rum every night, but it had to be signed by the medical officer. So you can imagine how popular he became on a cold night.
But you don't think drink was involved too much with the Christmas truce, is that right?
No, I don't think so at all. I think the men may have had a double tot, but it was all official, anything like that. After the war had recommenced, I went up to see the Lincoln colonel, and there I found the second in command and the adjutant, I can't remember their names, sitting down to a jolly good Christmas meal, which they'd sent across and told me to come and join. And we had roast pheasant, a wonderful way they could cook in those trenches on charcoal fires, roast pheasant and plum pudding and plenty of rum. Of course, the colonel could always get rather more than the ration. We had a real slap-up meal, and then I went off back to my little haystack.
Did you see much of the French at that time, 1914? The French? The winter of 14, early 15?
No. The village by Lavantine, in front of Lavantine where we were, was full of hens, mostly without any tail feathers, having been chased by the troops. The odd cow, but there were no French at all, they'd all gone very wildly too. But we lived fairly well on the proceeds for a little bit. We'd eaten all the chickens and